Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin our program with the latest on health and healing, including understanding the power of exercise throughout your life and what it means in the last stages of life. Also, when you eat your cruciferous vegetables, which I'm hopeful you're doing, what are you really benefiting from? I'm going to give you all the good reasons to eat your vegetables every single day. They do make an enormous difference in whether or not you develop certain diseases, and I'll go into that in depth. And also, today we're going to look at the different nutrients we take in and how they impact our longevity, plus more. Then from our environmental segment, we're going to look at the Amazon deforestation and it's rising, and the government is moving to actually increase the destruction of the Amazon, supporting corporations that are exploiting it, and limiting or destroying indigenous protections of the natives there. Why? Why would you take one of the two great rainforests of the world, consider the lungs of the world, because they trap carbon? It's a carbon sink. And instead, when you destroy those trees, you end up having then a carbon release. So you go from storing carbon to releasing carbon. And then you create desertification. Why? I'll explore that. Also today, I'm going to engage in a lot of commentaries. Some commentaries I've written, and one in particular, because it's time that we pull back a step and looked at the world we live in. I've been doing a series in the last four or five programs on the state of the world, the death of liberalism and the ascent of neoliberalism and globalization, the responsibilities by both the Democrat and Republican movements, the attacks against real conservatives and real liberals, the morphing into a more progressive movement in the third-party candidacy. And today I'm adding to that. I'm going to talk about what I would hope would be a resurgence of a new type of feminism. Not the type espoused by Madonna, but more of the spiritual feminist. I'll explain in detail. And to give an example of what's happening in front of us, and do we care? Now, of course, many people in this audience do care. But for the average person, if I ask them anything about the world we live in, about, for example, tell me the different feedback loops in the environment that are already tipping and cannot be changed, they wouldn't know. They might know the term global warming, but they would know none of the details of what causes it or how to stop it. For those of you who are constantly engaged, that would seem like a no-brainer. But for the average person, you're dealing with a no-brainer, a person who engages not in some inherent genetic defect that allows them not to be aware, but rather intentional ignorance. And intentional ignorance is not relegated to those who are uneducated. I can show you a simple axiom, and I came to this understanding years ago, that the more educated a person is in a specialty, the more difficult it is for them to surrender the rightness of that, since almost all that they do for the remainder of their life is to defend and protect the rightness of their thoughts. So if you're a physician or an engineer, or if you're a, let's say, a geneticist, then you have to believe absolutely. You have to be such a true believer that you are virtually indistinguishable from a cultist. You can't allow anyone else's ideas in, and you must attack anyone who even purports to have an issue understanding that you lack. So today, the issue will be examining contemporary feminism and on a humanitarian level, and what are the ways that we as a nation, male and female feminists, people unfortunately have only thought of feminists as those who are a female. That is not true. And what would be some of the causes that I think most people could respond to and align with so we can actually make a difference by what we do and educate ourselves even more on these topics and align with those people who have spent a lifetime working generally unheralded and unrecognized. So we don't have to start from scratch in any of the social movements. We simply have to find them, examine them, and see how we can do something. Also today, a commentary from a short comment. These are all going to be short commentaries from The Intercept, Naomi Klein. Get ready for the first shocks of Trump's disaster capitalism. I'm going to tie a couple of those in because what she says is the likely outcome. I went down to New Orleans after Katrina and I saw it. I interviewed hundreds of people. I filmed, I saw what was going on, and that is what Trump is going to be giving us nonstop. By the way, Obama gave us the same thing, as did Bush, as did Clinton, as did Reagan. I'll explain it. And then what would be another way of approaching rebuilding our infrastructure? Well, Professor Ellen Brown has a very good and simple way of dealing with that, and I'll share that with you as well. Also from Jeffrey St. Clair from Counterpunch, the president who was not there, Barack Obama's legacy of impotence. And of all the different things I've read about Obama's legacy, this would be, I consider, the best. Also from Professor Henry Giroux on revisiting Orwell's 1984 in Trump's America. Now, I don't know how many of these I'll have a chance to get on the program, probably not all, but I will get a few on that I think are very important. For example, right now, Trump has already shown that he's really tough on terrorists. Really? Well, his first effort caused the death of a group of innocent civilians, 12 of them, in Yemen. Why are we in Yemen? What is the purpose of this fight in Yemen? I'll explain. And when we're told that he's banning 7 countries from getting in the United States over the next 90 days, what about where the real terrorists come from? Because my research and scholarship shows there's not been a single terrorist attack by anyone from the countries that he is targeting, but the countries he does business with, like Saudi Arabia, oh yeah, lots of terrorists. And I'll go into that as well. We'll also be hearing by one of the world's, in my opinion, most respected feminists, talking about how we can realign with what is occurring. And you talk about hypocrisy. Wherever I see it, I'm going to call it out. And I'm going to play 2 audio clips today to show you absolute hypocrisy. Where was the media? Where was the outrage? Where were the protests? Where were the marches? Where were the sit-ins when Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Obama wanted to support a wall? Now, I'm opposed to the wall. I think it's stupid for many reasons I'll get into on another occasion. But if they supported it, which they did, and I'll play you their audio clips, virtually no different than Obama, than Trump, why was there no outrage? And there should have been. So we're going to have an interesting show today. Let's begin. First off, we know that we should be exercising. And unfortunately, you can't do 2 things simultaneously. You can't be watching 6.5 hours of television or internet watching per day and then have adequate time to go out and exercise. Also, think of the time we spend eating. Think of what we eat. Think of how we feel after we eat. We're generally bloated. We've eaten too much. We have way too much protein, way too much carbohydrate and sugars. And that creates a roller coaster of energy. We also are overstressing our adrenal glands. We're walking around with adrenal exhaustion. Sit in front of a computer, electromagnetic pulses. Sit in front of a television, electromagnetic pulses. Use your cell phone, electromagnetic pulses. They're all impacting the hippocampus in the brain, the pituitary gland, and the pineal gland. All of those can then adversely affect your energy level. We're also adversely affecting our chromosomes, our telomeres. We're shortening the telomeres. We're speeding up the aging process. Certainly those cells have been impacted, like in the brain. So when you look at a lack of energy, when you look at not putting it into your schedule, when you think that you no longer need to exercise or not today, there's a consequence, and it's always cumulative. This is from McMaster's University in Ontario, and they're talking about what I just mentioned, parking yourself in front of a TV, and then what happens is you actually speed up the development of dementia. They looked at 1,600 adults, and these people had sedentary lives. And they found that their increased risk of dementia was substantial. Quote, being inactive may completely negate the protective effects of healthy lifestyle. So you can't have it both ways. You can't have a healthy diet and then not exercise and expect to be healthy. You have to do it all. Otherwise, it's like saying, hey, come over and look at this engine. Perfect, shiny, chrome-plated. It's a 500 horsepower. And you go, wow, what an engine. Can we go for a drive? Well, I don't have any tires, but we can look at the engine. It's that kind of mindset. We think as long as we do something that's healthy, we've done everything that's necessary to be healthy. And by the way, I saw this a long time ago. I remember back at the very beginning of my professional career, I was invited to do a talk on natural hygiene because I had written a book on food combining and natural hygiene. I went to a little compound upstate in the area of Sullivan County, New York, and the Catskills. And I got there on a Friday evening, and the place was packed. It was one, looked like an old rundown resort building. There was a swimming pool that was all cracked and broken inside. There was a tennis court that had overgrown, so clearly no one was using any of this. But the people were very nice. They were all very old. And I noticed how many of them were very, what I would consider, not just thin, but unhealthily skinny. And because their idea was to chew your food like 100 times and have a lot of it raw. A lot of good principles. They were vegan, but they didn't exercise. They didn't do meditation. They didn't have a way of dealing with stress. And I felt that they were all suffering from negative nitrogen balance, meaning they didn't have enough protein. And but as we talked, the only thing in their life that they thought was important to be healthy was natural hygiene, nothing else. They wouldn't take any vitamins or supplements or protein powders, nothing. And I was always taught to be polite and to, in an environment, to listen, especially those who were older than me. Well, I was in my early 20s. These people were in their 60s and 70s. So I listened and I watched and I observed. The food was tasteless. They thought somehow it was decadent to make food taste good. Their idea was, however nature produced it, that's as good as it should taste. And it didn't. They made these little, they made this some kind of casserole that tasted like mud. And, but that's fine. And that was the beginning of me appreciating people who find one piece of a puzzle to life and that becomes their life. When done properly, I believe that we never stop finding pieces of puzzle to put together. In any case, they didn't exercise. They had no muscle mass at all. And so be active. Eat right and be active. You got to do both. And if you do both, then you do have a chance of living a longer life. This was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, by the way. Also from the Babel University of Medical Sciences, which is in Iran, they looked at the effects of green tea on oxidative stress and also cognitive function in patients with Alzheimer's, and they found it was really substantial. They published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurodegenerative Diseases and Conditions, and they found that if you took green tea a couple times a day for a couple months, you substantially negated oxidative stress, which is a major cause of aging and diseases. Quote, the findings indicate the consumption of green tea for 2 months by the improvement of antioxidant systems exerts beneficial effects on cognitive function. And this was published in the Caspian Journal of Internal Medicine. So what we have is one more piece of the puzzle. Green tea, I'm suggesting 200 milligrams three times a day or 600 milligrams. If a person has cognitive dysfunction, memory loss, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, then I start at 1,000 milligrams in divided doses, like 500 milligrams twice a day. And then I go up from there. I might go up 2,000, 3,000, always decaffeinated because it can really make a difference. And then from the University of Erlanga in Indonesia, they found that pregnant women should take more micronutrients, aside from iron and folic acid, to boost the long-term cognitive development of their children. And this was a major follow-up study from Indonesia. So they looked at 31,290 pregnant women, and they found that these micronutrients, selenium is a micronutrient, manganese is another micronutrient, and the more these micronutrients you have in your system, like zinc, iodine, B6, the healthier your brain, central nervous system, the healthier pregnancy. And then when they assessed the children 3 to 5 years later, they had better cognitive function. And after 10 years, still better social environmental factors benefited the children. So they followed these children for almost 14 years. And so if you want healthier children, adolescents, teenagers, it all starts in the mother making sure that she has all these micronutrients which are passed on to the developing fetus. And also from the University of Naples, which is in Italy, they found that the polyphenol-rich virgin olive oil reduces insulin resistance and liver inflammation and improves mitochondrial function. So you're going to have better energy because that's your mitochondria, your energy factories. You're going to have less inflammation in your liver. That's good for people who have been eating sugar or have cirrhosis or hepatitis, any of the inflammatory conditions of the liver. So your liver is going to be healthier. And if you're diabetic or pre-diabetic, you're going to have better use of your insulin and glucose. You're not going to have those spikes in your blood sugar. That's terrific. So eating olives, that's really good for you. Or drinking extra virgin olive oil. And if you've been in Italy, it depends upon which part of Italy and whether it's in the cities or whether it's in the country. But if you're looking at traditional Italian culture, they might have an antipasta. And their antipastas always seem to taste better. I think it's because they don't use thick cuts of eggplant that we do in the United States. They use very thin cuts of zucchini, a yellow zucchini, green zucchini, eggplant, thinly cut portobello mushrooms, thinly cut into strips the onions. They lightly grill them, and then they baste them in olive oil and seasonings. That's one way before they start a meal. And that's getting a lot of the different nutrients into your system. And the system benefits from it. But also, instead of having, as we frequently have, butter or margarine, they'll have a whole grain bread, and in the middle of the table they'll have 3 or 4 different cups of olive oils. Now, depending upon if they make their own olive oil, which a lot of Italians and Greeks do, it'll be very thick. In some cases, it's unpalatable to the American taste because it's not refined. It's really healthy. I mean, extremely healthy. And they dip their bread in that and soak it. You're getting like one or two teaspoons of olive oil just from that. Forget any of the other things you eat. We like things very refined. Well, when you refine something, you're taking out the polyphenols, the antioxidants, the proanthocyanidins. You're taking out the very nutrients that make it healthy. So deep-colored, extra virgin, organic cold-press olive oil. And it can turn off inflammation. It can be wonderful for you. And also, one thing, I always like to impart something new each day. And there is what is called crystallized intelligence. What that means is simple. A crystallized intelligence is the ability to use a lifetime's accumulation of skills and knowledge that you've learned and earned. Now, that's compared to fluid intelligence, on the other hand, is the ability to solve new problems and use logic in new situations and identify new patterns of existence. Now, here's the problem. A recent study from the University of Illinois of aging adults, that means over the age of 50, has discovered a link between consumption of pigments found in leafy green vegetables to the preservation of crystallized intelligence. So what is this powerful pigment that accumulates in the brain and providing a neuroprotective role? It's lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N. I've mentioned it 1,000 times. Eat your kale, spinach, your cruciferous vegetables, cabbage, broccoli. All of these contain lutein. And we need that. And it's also found in high concentrations in the macula of the human eye. And the study was published in Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience. And these were healthy people, but it makes a big difference because if you're over the age of 40, the probability is that you're going to keep yourself focused upon your crystallized intelligence, meaning what you've learned in the past, you simply keep repeating every day. So those with higher serum lutein levels also tend to have thicker gray matter in the parahippocampal cortex, a brain region that, like crystallized intelligence, is preserved in healthy aging. And so what you want is also you want the fluid intelligence. You want your brain to continue to grow. You want your brain to continue to analyze, to seek truths, to learn new information, to learn how to break through problems into solutions. That's your liquid. And for that, you have to have a very healthy brain. And that's why as we age, if we don't change our diet, we don't change our lifestyles, we stay stuck with what we had from the past. Now, if you exercise and you eat moderately and you don't smoke or drink, then you'll have that probably until your mid-60s. And then you'll start to have a lot of breakages of the dendrites in the brain. You'll have a lot of synaptic dysfunction. You'll have mitochondrial depletion. You'll have neural damage that won't be repaired. And so you'll begin to lose your short-term memory, but you'll still have your long-term memory. And that's when dementia begins. That's when we begin to really age our brain. Your brain will age faster than the rest of your body. And that's why a person on the outside could look relatively healthy. But on the inside of that brain, it's going. And we really need a rejuvenation of the brain program. Now, come the time when I come back to New York, and that will be, and I might even do it by webinar before then. Normally, I like to do it when I have a group in front of me so I can look in the eyes of the group. But I'm going to do, my next health support group will be a reversing brain aging of every kind of problem with the brain. And it'll be a 6-month study group. And I believe in 6 months, with all that we know now, we can de-age your brain by, in 6 months, 10 years. That's how much advanced knowledge we have now. But if we don't apply this, then we begin to not use liquid intelligence and we use crystallized intelligence, and that's going to keep us from growing. And finally today, I realize I'm taking a little more on health and nutrition, but I believe it's necessary. I'm a big believer in cruciferous vegetables, especially if a person has cancer, weakened immune system, if they're autotoxic, meaning they've eaten and drank a lot of things that are not healthy for them, then you have to compensate. You have to overcompensate by giving more juices, really cleanse, not just once a day, but maybe 4 or 5 times a day. And the brassica family, that's B-R-A-S-S-I-C-A, that's your cruciferous. That means broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cabbage and mustard, and cauliflower and kale and radishes and rutabaga and turnips, even arugula. Those are all in the cruciferous family. And the more you use of it, the more detoxified you are. Why? Because of what is known as sulfurophane. Sul, S-U-L, S-U-L, fura, F-O-R-A, fane, P-H-A-N-E, sulfurophane. It's a phytochemical. It's very abundant in cruciferous vegetables. And it is great because it starts with what is called glucopyrimin. And sulfurophane is produced when the enzyme, what is called myrosinase, converts this gluco, which is G-L-U-C-O, orafenanin, P-H-A-N-I-N. You don't need to know that, but I just like to share. We have scientists and dietitians and physicians, nurses listening, and nutritionists, so I like to give them the actual biochemistry. And then you have a natural compound found in some plants, which is called glucosinolate. And this gluco, G-L-U-C-O, sinolate, S-I-N-O-L-A-T-E, through a chemical reaction induced by damage to the plant, such as cutting or chewing. And then all this begins to create a precursor to sulfurophane. And it just so happens that cruciferous vegetables contain a remarkable amount of this chemical, which makes them powerhouses of nature. I mean, these are really superfoods. And there's an enormous amount of research out there now into the wide array of applications of sulfurophane. And what does it do? Well, let me tell you some things it does. And this is why you should have your servings of your cruciferous every day. It's anti-cancer. Sulfurophane is increasingly referred to as an anti-cancer compound. And it's a potent antioxidant. It's anti-inflammatory. It's very similar at the level of your cell as turmeric or curcumin. In fact, one promising preclinical study found that the combination of sulfurophane and curcumin was effective for a chemo prevention of pancreatic cancer. But it doesn't stop there. Sulfurophane also has been studied for the prevention and treatment of several types of cancer, including stomach, bladder, breast, prostate, lung, colon, and skin. And specifically, research indicates sulfurophane possesses the capacity to intervene in multi-stage carcinogenesis through the modulation and regulation of important cellular mechanisms. In effect, it kills cancer cells, malignant cancer cells. And so it really reduces prostate cancer. And broccoli sprouts are probably the number one detoxification element that you can take into your body. And it's really good if you have cancer of the head and neck. Cruciferous contains extracts that are effective at inhibiting lung adenocarcinomas, which is a malignant tumor formed from glandular structures and epithelial tissue, colon polyps, and skin cancer. And in skin cancer research, the protection offered by sulfurophane against a carcinogen in humans is catalytic and long-lasting. And broccoli sprouts are one of your richest sources of antioxidants, and it's great in stimulating the immune system. And then it's also good for depression relief. Cruciferous and sulfurophane can also significantly benefit people who have depression. There are studies that show has an antidepressant and effect, an anxiety-reducing effect upon the body. It also turns off inflammation in the brain. And we know that inflammation in the brain is one of the causes of depression. It helps with pain relief, all kinds of pain relief, especially when combined with vitamin C. So if you put some vitamin C in a juice with cruciferous vegetables, you're really reducing pain. It's cardioprotective. It is one of the best things you can do to help prevent a heart attack. And it also is rich in antioxidants. It's protective against toxins in the body. So if you have been in a toxic environment, taking your cruciferous vegetables helps to grab these toxins and take them out of the system. It's terrific for diabetics. It helps you there. It also helps destroy Helicobacter pylori. The Helicobacter is a bacterium, and the bacteria Helicobacter is most famously associated with stomach ulcers and in some cases gastric cancer. So our sulfurophane-laden cruciferous friends happen to offer distinct support in eliminating the colonization of this organism in our body. So that's good. and it helps with Alzheimer's disease as well. And because of furfane compounds, especially broccoli juice, broccoli sprout juice, is like 2 ounces at a time, like wheatgrass juice, extremely beneficial because it upregulates intercellular glutathione, and that's terrific for detoxification. And it's one of the best anti-inflammatories you can ever find. So those are some reasons why you should be having the cruciferous vegetables. We're halfway through our program. Have a lot more to share with you. Please stay with us. Back in a moment.
When you're smiling,
when you're smiling,
when you're smiling,
when you're smiling,
and the whole world smiles with you.
Smiles with you.
And when you're laughing,
when you're laughing,
oh, you're laughing,
oh, you're laughing.
Mm, when the sun comes
shining through.
When you're crying,
when you're crying,
you bring on the rain.
Bring on the
stop
rain.
Your sad.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. What I'd like to do now is play a little segment here on, yes, people should be outraged by many of the things Trump is doing and the people he surrounded himself with. But why weren't we also outraged when Obama did it? That's the hypocrisy that I'm seeing, and I believe we should call out. Listen in.
Streets over the election of Donald Trump. They say a major reason for their protests, Trump claims that he will deport at least 2 to 3 million illegal immigrants. So if that is truly important to them, why have none of these people protested that President Obama has actually deported more than 3 million people since taking office? This is a reality check you won't see anywhere else.
No Donald Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA!
Yeah, the protests have been loud and they've gotten a lot of media attention. The claim is that President-elect Donald Trump will unfairly deport millions of undocumented immigrants. So before we look at the hypocrisy here, let's listen to what Donald Trump has actually said.
What we are going to do is get the people that are criminal and have criminal records, gang members, drug dealers. We have a lot of these people, probably 2 million, it could even be 3 million. We're getting them out of our country or we're going to incarcerate.
All right, so Donald Trump wants to deport 2 to 3 million undocumented immigrants with criminal backgrounds. And into the streets, protesters flow. Okay, but where have those protesters been over the past 8 years? Because according to the Pew Research data analysis that was released in August, get this, the Obama administration has deported an unprecedented 2.4 million illegal immigrants between 2009, when he took office, and 2014. That was the last year data was available. So with 2 years left on his term, Obama had already deported well above Trump's minimum estimate of 2 million undocumented immigrants. Now, let's go a little further on this, because if you take the numbers from 2014 alone, it's over 414,000 immigrants who were deported. It's not even his highest year. But if we assume that 2015 and 2016 will match 2014's number, then we can reasonably estimate that over the course of his term, President Obama will have deported at least 3.2 million people by the end of this year. So how many people is that? Well, according to governmental data, the Obama administration has deported more people than any other president's administration in history. In fact, they have deported more than the sum of all the presidents of the 20th century. So just let that sink in for a minute. More deportations than all the presidents of the 20th century combined. What you need to know is that the hypocrisy here is almost infuriating. If you are against Donald Trump's plans to deport up to 3 million immigrants, okay, you have every right and you probably should protest. But if you are infuriated that Donald J. Trump wants to do it, and yet you were silent as Barack Obama actually did it, are you really interested in solving the problem? Or are you just opportunistically outraged? That's reality check. Let's talk about that.
All right. Something to think about. And that's true of everything. By the way, for Trump, Trump has now let his mad dog general start in Yemen. And here's the reality. Dozens killed in Yemen in first U.S. Special Forces raid under Trump's first authorized operation. Okay. And how many of those were civilians? Well, here's the game they play. Any person that looks like they're over the age of 10 is considered an enemy combatant. You could be a girl, you could be a boy, you could be a child. You're going to be called a terrorist. They've gotten away with this crime against humanity. And every one of those people sitting right now in those bunkers out in Las Vegas killing innocent people, you should be held accountable. You should spend the rest of your life in prison. And every single person in the Pentagon, the Defense Department, if we're going to hold the Nazis, which we did, but not enough of them, accountable for crimes against humanity, against the Jews and the Gypsies and the blacks, then we should hold any American in any position that was a part of the authorization of a crime that is a crime based upon the Nuremberg Convention and the Geneva Accords. Otherwise, once again, we're hypocrites. 16 civilians minimally were killed. So, Mr. Trump, you now have 16 innocent people that you killed. I didn't hear you apologize or your general apologize. So is this the beginning of the massive carnage that we've seen with every single president from Reagan, Carter, Clinton's, as co-presidents, Bush? None of them apologized for the innocent people's lives that were lost. But what if this would have been 16 innocent Americans killed? That would be everyone's front page news story. If it bleeds, it leads in the United States, but not when it's someone in another country that is disempowered. The poorest nation, by the way, country in the Middle East is Yemen. And how bad is it? Well, since you have unlimited amounts of our money that you're willing to give your corrupt, and all of them are corrupt, in my opinion, sociopaths that you surround yourself with, the reality is that one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from war-related starvation. I suggest people take a look at the truth. Saudi Arabia is the number one supporter of terrorism in the world. They arm, they teach, they protect, they promote their madrasas, their religious schools, which is the most rabid, hate-filled, evil form of education. It's Wahhabist division of, and by the way, most Muslims disagree with that Wahhabism. But these are the people that cut off the heads, that throw gays off buildings and kill them, that will put a woman and bury her up to her head and then have the village come and stone her to death. Every form of horrendous, brutal contempt they have for anything resembling humane treatment, they do not have. And yet they're killing people, supporting all the terrorist activities. Well, why would you not put them on a terrorist list? The majority of the people who attacked us in 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia. The 28 pages actually was 64,000 pages, and in it completely indicts members of the royal family and the funding of foundations and individuals. Why don't you hold them accountable? Why would you not put the, is it because you're doing business in Saudi Arabia? Could be. Because you're functionally illiterate? Absolutely. Because maybe something more than three syllables is a little confusing to you? Probably. Whatever disclaimer your apologists want to make for you, you are engaging and supporting terrorist activities, both when you kill innocent civilians in a country that you should not be in, and that country is the bottom end of Saudi Arabia, geographically on a map. And it represents no threat to anyone. But they had a head of that country who was a puppet for Saudi Arabia, who was a Sunni and practicing Wahhabism, and he deprived the Shia or other Sunnis who were not a part of that religious belief of supplies, food, water, attacked them, murdered them. So they threw him out, and rightly so, the Houthis. So now we are the ones who are causing a child to die every 10 minutes of starvation. So when will anyone march when there's children actually dying? Now, this is where each of us has to come to our own decision about the ethics of our being. And if we can be outraged by person's statements, which we should be, why are we absolutely silent and impotent when it comes to actual children dying in a war that we have been supporting with the airplanes, the intelligence, the bombs, Why isn't that also important? So that's on this president. That's how he starts. Now, Naomi Klein has something to say from The Intercept. This is short, but I thought it was relevant. We already know that the Trump administration plans to deregulate markets, wage all-out war on radical Islamic terrorism, trash climate science, and unleash a fossil fuel frenzy. It's a vision that can be counted on to generate a tsunami of crisis and shocks, economic shocks, as market bubbles burst, security shocks, as blowback from foreign belligerents comes home, weather shocks, as our climate is further destabilized, and industrial shocks as oil pipeline spills and rigs collapse, which they tend to do, especially when enjoying light-touch regulation. All this is dangerous enough. What's even worse is the way that the Trump administration can be counted on to exploit these shocks politically and economically. And here's what she says that I think is highly relevant. And I verified this for myself when I went down to New Orleans after Katrina. The role played by the man who is now the U.S. Vice President, Mike Pence. At the time Katrina hit New Orleans, Pence was chairman of the powerful and highly ideological Republican Study Committee. On September 13, 2005, just 14 days after the levees were breached and with parts of New Orleans still underwater, the Republican group convened a fateful meeting at the House offices of the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Under Pence's leadership, the group came up with a list of pro-free market ideas for responding to Hurricane Katrina and high gas prices. 32 policies in all, each one straight out of the disaster capitalism playbook. Now, to get a sense of how the Trump administration will respond to its first crisis, it's worth reading the list in full. What stands out in the package of pseudo-relief policies is the commitment to wage all-out war on labor standards and on the public sphere, which is ironic because the failure of public infrastructure is what turned Katrina into a human catastrophe. Also notable was the determination to use any opportunity to strengthen the hand of oil and gas industry. The first three items on the list are, quote, automatically suspend Davis-Bacon prevailing wage law in disaster areas, a reference to the law that required federal contractors to pay a living wage, make the, quote, the entire affected area a flat tax free enterprise zone, and make, quote, the entire region an economic competitiveness zone. Well, another demand called for giving parents vouchers to use at charter schools move perfectly in line with the vision held by Trump's pick as Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. All these measures were announced by President George Bush within a week. Under pressure, Bush was eventually forced to reinstate the labor standards, though they were largely ignored by contractors. There is every reason to believe that this will be the model for the multi-billion-dollar infrastructure investment Trump is using to court the labor movement. Repealing Glass-Bacon for those projects was reportedly already floating at Monday's meeting with leaders of construction and building trade unions. Back in 2005, the Republican Study Committee meeting produced more ideas that gained presidential support. Climate scientists have directly linked the increased intensity of hurricanes to warming of ocean temperatures. This connection, however, didn't stop Pence and the Republican Committee from calling on Congress to repeal environmental regulations on the Gulf Coast, giving permission for new oil refineries in the United States and to greenlight drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, all of which, by the way, President Obama and Hillary Clinton approved of and supported. This is not just Republican. All these measures are a surefire way to drive up greenhouse gas emissions, the major human contributor to climate change. Yet they were immediately championed by the president under the guise of responding to a devastating storm. The oil industry wasn't the only one to profit from Hurricane Katrina, of course. So did a slew of well-connected contractors who turned the Gulf Coast into a laboratory for privatized disaster response. The companies that snatched up the biggest contracts were the familiar gang from the invasion of Iraq. Halliburton, KBR unit, won a $60 million gig to reconstruct military bases along the coast. Blackwater was hired to protect FEMA employees from looters. Parsons, infamous for its sloppy Iraq work, was brought in for a major bridge construction project in Mississippi. Flora, Shaw, and Bechtel, and CH2M Hill All contractors in Iraq were hired by the government to provide mobile homes to evacuees. Just 10 days after the levees broke, their contracts ended up totaling $3.4 billion. No open bidding was required, and no opportunity for profit was left untapped. Kenyon, a division of the mega funeral conglomerate Services Corporation International, a major Bush campaign donor, was hired to retrieve the dead from homes and streets. The work was extraordinarily slow, and bodies were left in the broiling sun for days. Emergency workers and local volunteer morticians were forbidden to step in to help because handling the bodies impinged on Kenyon's commercial territory. And as with so many of Trump's decisions so far, relevant experience often appeared to have nothing to do with how contractors were allocated. Ashbrit, a company paid $500 million to remove debris, did not even own a single dump truck. Hence, it farmed it all out, the entire job, to subcontractors. Even more striking was the company that FEMA paid $5.2 million to perform a crucial role in building a base camp for emergency workers in St. Bernard's Parish, a suburb of New Orleans. The camp construction fell behind schedule and was never completed. When the contractor was investigated, it emerged that the company, Lighthouse Disaster Relief, was actually a religious group. Quote, "About the closest thing I've done to this is just organize a youth camp with my church," said the director. After all the layers of subcontractors had taken their cut, there was next to nothing left for the people doing the work. For instance, the author, Mike Davis, tracked the way FEMA paid Shaw $175 a square foot to install blue tarps on damaged roofs, even though the tarps themselves were provided free by the government. Once all the subcontractors took their share, the workers who actually hammered the tarps were paid $2 a square foot. Every level of the contracting food chain, in other words, is grotesquely overfed except the bottom rung, where the actual work is carried out. Now, I was down there, and I was curious about how they were doing this and who was doing it, because let me show you what it looks like. Let's say that you have a home, and the people were flooded up to the 9-foot level, because I went over and personally measured it, going down a street, every single house, whether poor or nice neighborhood, had a water line. Well, most of the attics were above the 9-foot line, generally a 10-foot. And you went into the attic, and then you had to knock a hole in your roof in order to have air and to get out, depending on the roof. So let's say you have a three foot by three foot or a 9-square-foot hole. Now, what should have been done is you could put a temporary patch on it. You put a piece of plywood down, you seal all the sides of the pressurized plywood, and that way at least water wouldn't continue to go into the house, and that would cost you the cost of a piece of pressurized plywood and your sealant material. Some form of caulking, a rubberized caulking, would do fine. Or, if you didn't want to do that, you could take some heavy tarp, and you could then staple in or gun in the tarp over that hole, and then sealed the outside of that tarp with some form of adhesive that would be strong enough to be water barrier. It's a temporary relief. And that might cost you, if you and I did it, either one's going to cost you under $35, $40. Well, now someone is saying that a tarp in, let's say, is 10 foot by 10 foot or 20 by 20, and you're charging by the square foot. So if you're charging, just for an example, let's just take their figure. Let's just say that it's $175 a square foot, and let's say that they've got 300 square feet. That's $525 that someone, the contractor, is making. But he's going to pay not $175, he's paying $2 for the person that actually gets up there and staples it in place. But the tarp was free, so he has no expense. So he's netting $173 a square foot minus the $2 given someone to put in. Now visualize that everywhere, on every project. In comes the big people who will take over a bridge project, a tunnel project. Every project that will be taken over already is being selected by the business roundtable. The people in powerful positions will have their contractors say, "We'll take the bridge contract. Do you have any experience building bridges?" "No, but we'll sub out to subcontractors, but we want $1,000 a square foot, and we'll pay the subcontractor $100 a square foot, and the subcontractor will pay the actual person doing the work $5 a square foot. Have a nice day, everyone.
Oh, Marie.
Oh, Marie.
Oh, Marie.
Oh, Marie.